say it this way, as far as introduction, we could spend a lot of time, but I don't want to do that. I'd like to really read the flood narrative. It's the longest narrative in all of the section of Genesis 1 to 11. Perhaps wouldn't read all of it, but at least chapters 6, 7, and 8. And because I think that, as in all these cases, the story is much more important than our little pulling it apart. And in this case, you should almost get it. A few little introductory remarks may be helpful, though. One is that the more I study this, the more I feel that this is a complement to Genesis chapter 1. That the creation must have this sort of supplement that you have in the story of the flood. Namely, that our existence is not only that we're God's creatures, but that we exist as an endangered species. We exist only because we are rescued from catastrophe. That means that he who is the creator is also the destroyer. And that if there's a beginning, there is also an end. Usually the flood is not pictured that way. It's put just in historical terms, and people send out expeditions for the ark and all these sorts of things. But I think that it tells us something about our present life, as all these primeval stories do, telling us two things. One, no doubt about the catastrophe. But if it was just a catastrophe story, it wouldn't be the interesting story that it is. And the other thing, the rescue. And if it was only the rescue, then it wouldn't be nearly as interesting as it is. So in other words, what we've got kind of two motifs, and they almost come back and forth at it. Now, you'll notice at the top of this edited sheet that I gave you, I have a picture of the St. Louis Arch. Without your glasses, you maybe don't see it there, Paul.
I can see it from here.
You can see it. This is an honor view. In other words, I'm just talking now about structure. What kind of a story is it? If it's a story, not just a crime and punishment the way we had all these other stories, but more like Genesis chapter 1, a story that talks about creation, endangered creation, endangered creatures, and about a catastrophe that is possible at any time. And whenever there is a catastrophe, somehow this flood story comes out. I guess the first time it ever grabbed me was during the war. Some pastor, he was a bit of a kook, but somehow or other, he, when everything was falling apart and chaos was beginning, he preached on the flood. And he didn't do it in a fundamentalistic manner, even though that was his approach generally. But somehow or other, this was an end, and it was an end that was brought by God. So that when the text says here, the end of all flesh is before me, it's the Hebrew word is kates. And some of you might know that this is the word that's used by the prophets when Amos sees the autumn fruit, the kayets. He says, the winter won't be far behind, the kates is here. And that's the same word that's used here. And so that it's a story of, well, that's why I put the arch there. First of all, the waters rising, and they rise until you come to a climax where God remembers as if he forgot Noah and all that are in the ark, and the winds come to assuage it, and it's a very significant date, we'll talk about that, that's given there, the 7th month, the 17th date, and then the waters assuage and it goes down. Now, if that's all you had, again, it wouldn't be understandable. So what I put on each side of this is the introduction and the conclusion. It reminds me, I went down to the Trojan power plant, this nuclear plant that has caused so much trouble and gotten a lot of people in jail down in Oregon on the Columbia River. I'm glad what they have there. Before you go in and before you go out, you must have some sort of interpretation or you don't know what you see. You can take a long and so forth. So, and of course, it's naturally heavily slanted by the light company. The Oregon Light Company tell you what you're going to see and what it is all about. But then you see it. And when you come out, then you get another a verb of what you're seeing. And so I would suggest that the structure here is a long introduction, a rather important introduction, And then a long conclusion. Now, I'm quite sure in our session today, can we ask some more of these, but that we won't be able to go through, especially the last part, the conclusion. We might be able to, and I would like to, take care of the introduction, and maybe they'll read rather quickly the actual account itself, because in some ways it doesn't need a lot of comment. Well, so much for just a general introduction. I wonder whether we could just go around, and since you don't have your glasses, we'll pass you up. But Jeanette, would you mind reading for us there the first chapter 6, 5 to 8? We'll just simply read it, and then we'll comment as we go on here. A real Bible class.
Deeply distressed, the Creator decided...
Well, yeah, that's just my editing, so why don't you read just the sacred part?
All right.
I don't mind the other parts.
The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth.
Does anyone have any comments, as we sometimes ask you? Anything strike you? Anything that you'd like to ask about or comment about or criticize if you don't like the way they tell it? Mm-hmm. It's really quite interesting.
I kind of thought that the flood came mainly with regard to man, but it sounds like the beasts and the birds and things like that were also obliterated.
Yeah. Now that's very interesting. What you're pointing out, an important thing. I think the center is always on man, no doubt about it. But not just on one man. That's why he has his whole family, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and all of his wives. It's a family of men that survives. You see, when you have a catastrophe, it's only a few people that really survive. And that's what happened here. And then it's more creatures. You see that? Living creatures. I think that's the reason. Now, please don't ask me about the freshwater fish and the saltwater fish and how come the fish get through it. Because and that's a scientific question that I'm afraid this story won't answer. Do you see that? But I think your observation is important, that notice here, the imagination of the thoughts of his heart and only evil continually. You can hardly say it worse.
Yeah, well, it's the humanization of God, I think, too, is talking about a part of God.
Yes, yes, yes. He's sorry. He never is sorry that he made the sparrows or the slugs or the salmon or the other birds, but I'm sorry that I made man. Now, this actually happens to be the Yahwist version here that uses the name for God, Yahweh, Lord, this little section. Later on, we'll get into the next section, which is largely the P version. And there you'll see it's a little more cold. The Lord isn't quite so disturbed. Here it says it grieved him to his heart. On the one hand, what grieves him? Well, the fact that his nice creation isn't turning out so well. All the dangerous possibilities of finally eventuating in a terrible sort of growth of wickedness. And secondly, that he's got to do something about it. You see that? So it grieves him in his heart, and he's sorry. But then comes this nice little statement, Noah found favor. The old King James had grace. It's a good word for king, favor, in the eyes of the Lord. He was somebody that's at least open. And I suppose that's what happens. Well, let's go on to the next part. I did give this, and I'm always editing is pushing a little. I think that the priestly version always stresses that when God gives a command, then something happens, and especially man must obey. We had that in Genesis chapter 1, where in all the seven masterpieces God said, let there be, and there was, and then he saw how good it was. And all the way through, the priests will, if you really want to get a good example of Ezekiel, Ezekiel will always have God speaking, hardly ever any narrative, and except that then you have to follow. Son of man, he looks way down upon the people who are way below. And so here too, it may seem a little cold. Ezekiel doesn't wear his heart on his sleeve as much as some of the others. Myron, would you mind reading, we'll just read rather quickly and we'll ask everybody around the room just to keep on reading. Would you read two verses there?
These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God. And Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth.
Okay, John, the next.
Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth.
Okay, right on next.
And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh,
For the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth.
All right, keep going.
Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make room in the ark and cover it inside and out with wood.
Keep right on.
This is how you are to make it: the length of the ark, 300 cubits. Its breadth, 50 cubits. Its height, 30 cubits. Make a roof for the ark and finish it to a cubit above, and set the doors of the ark in its side. Make it with lower, second, and third decks.
Okay, keep right on.
For behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, in which is the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall die.
And now the whole long section.
But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall come into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark, to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds according to their kinds, and of the animals according to their kind. Of every creeping thing of the ground according to its kind, two of every sort shall come in to you, to keep them alive. Also take with you every sort of food that is eaten and stored up, and it shall serve as food for you and for them.
All right, and Bob, would you take verse 22 as the climax, really?
Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him.
Yeah, now that's one little section, and let's just look it over. Any comments? We find made a few remarks about it. Here you've got what is kind of a hallmark throughout the book of Genesis. It doesn't continue in the rest of the Pentateuch, because by that time you've got a salvation history. But it's called, these are the generations of Noah. Remember we had it in chapter 2, verse 4, where it says these are the generations of heaven and earth when God made them. And now you've got the, we didn't study that one, Genesis 5, this is the generations of Adam. And now comes the generations of Noah. That's precisely the way in which the priestly people, I think clergymen usually keep records like that. They like to keep things in order. And I don't know all clergymen, but they have got to keep certain orders. And the priests especially, they have to keep these things in order. They're interested in dates. We'll see that here. It's the 600th year of Noah's life when this happens. And I think that the announcement, when he announced the flood, comes, at least I'd be willing to try to prove that on their calendar, on the first day of the year, of the 600th year of Noah's life, so that when it's the New Year's and they can get out and it's dry, notice that that'll be the first day of the 601st year of Noah's life. So they're very exact here. Well, the way you have this version of it, and it's very similar, is that because of all flesh has corrupted its way, that's another way of speaking of man, now corruption, violence, he uses the word, the earth is filled with violence through them, so I'll destroy them with the earth. And then, now this is interesting, the only other place in all of the priestly telling where you have descriptions of a structure is the temple. And though this is only similar to the temple, I think the temple is 30 cubits high, and I think 30 wide, this is 50 wide, and 90 long, it's the proportions of 3 to 1. This is much longer, very, very long thing. How long is it? 300 cubits. And you've got to make, the word rooms isn't right, it's nests, little nests. In the Babylonian version, you have a cube, and you have it 7 stories high. This one is only 3. It doesn't tell you how to make it, and all attempts to recreate it don't really help too much. But the idea is that this is to be their home. And please don't ask me now, the next question is how they can ventilate it, or they have enough trouble in the zoos to get all in there. But it does mention the food here. Somehow this has to be the way in which you survive the catastrophe. And then comes an interesting thing. I'm going to establish my covenant. Now that was not mentioned in the Babylonian parallels. We have two parallels, the Epic of Gilgamesh and the Athrathris parallel. Covenant idea is specifically Israelite. We'll have a rainbow. And does anybody know what a rainbow is really for? Why do you have a bow up there in the sky? Why is it called a bow? It's an arc, isn't it? Well, why does the god, you have it in Wagner's Valhalla, the gods finally, the twilight of the gods, they go over this bridge and they finally get to Valhalla. That's one way of doing it. The Greeks had Iris, and there are lots of ways of doing it. But the idea here in this culture is that the god is angry, and what does he do? He shoots his war bow at everybody, and then there's pestilence. You have that Apollo in the Homer's Iliad shooting his arrows into the camp of the Greeks, and pestilence breaks out like that. Then what the god does when he's not angry is to do what? Put it up in the sky, and the storm is all over, and everything is nice. It's a very important significance. Now here, all it says, it doesn't mention the rainbow as such, we'll have that in chapter 9, but here it simply says, you can be sure that even though this catastrophe comes, that you will survive. That there is a promise. So there are really two decisions that God has made here. That's why he had so much trouble. On the one hand, a decision to destroy, but on the other hand, to have this asylum. I think that's why they have this business of the temple. It's like a temple. When the people go into it, they march in a procession. That's the way the priests always had everybody going up to Mount Zion. And then they came into the presence of God, and they were there protected by God. Here, God will close the door and let them in that. And when you were once in the temple, you were healed. You were really healed. You went to a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and you look at the Psalms and so forth. It healed you, body and soul. You got God's blessing. And when you're done with that, you're done with the pilgrimage, and you've been there in God's presence where he has preserved you, then you can have the procession out. So this whole thing that I call the St. Louis Arch, what you have on the one hand will always be entrance into the air. You'll have then a joyous exit. You'll have the rising of the waters, the falling of it, and you're all coming up to a climax. Well, all this, one other thing I could just mention here is that the last thing that Bob read is very important. That's what you should do. And here's why Noah is just. That's a covenant word. He is tzaddik, and he is a tamim. He is also blameless. He's not caught up with all the rest of what his generation had, this violence. And when God speaks to him, he obeys. He does it. There's no description here of how he made it. If you want the medieval mystery plays, then you've got Noah's wife who doesn't want to go in. And you have all kinds of things happening. Noah trying to get everybody. And there are other Jewish legends which even got into, I think, the book of James that tell you about how everybody else was supposed to get into the ark, but they wouldn't, and so forth. That's not mentioned in the Genesis account as such. He did it. But that's important, very important. If he hadn't done it, well, he hadn't done something for all mankind. So that's why I put it as what Noah accomplishes for all mankind by his obedience. I think that's the emphasis of the priests here. Now, any other comments there at this stage? It's a real long section, and I'm rushing through it a bit, but I think that a lot of this may become clear. It's not especially difficult. Tim, would you mind reading the next part, the whole business from 1 to 5?
I'm wondering if that's generalizable at all, the notion that our obedience is for others.
Oh, yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say that Noah is like Cain, every man, and like Adam, every man. Mm-hmm. This is a universal story. And it tells all of us that we live, despite all the catastrophes, as survivors. And I guess our present-day people, you know, spaceship Earth, is really in danger. And we live as endangered species.
And our obedience or disobedience has an effect on the rest of us.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. On the rest of us. Okay, I think that comes out clear in the next part, too. Tim?
Then the Lord said to Noah, go into the ark. You and all your household, for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. Take with you 7 pairs of all clean animals,
the male and his mate, and the pair of the animals that are not clean, the male and his mate, and seven pairs of the birds of the air also, male and female, to keep their kind alive upon the face of all the earth. For in 7 days I will send rain upon the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and every living thing that I have made I will blot out from the face of the ground.
And verse 5?
And Noah did all that the Lord had commanded him.
Yeah, that's very typical of the way the priest tells his story. Any comments on this? What about the clean and unclean? Anyone have any observation about that or thought about that?
Could he have eaten the thing? Could they have eaten the thing? Since they
told? Well, so far, we have to get to chapter 9 before they can eat animals anyway. They're only vegetarians. Remember that? That rather interesting part at the end of chapter 1. I've given you the herb and the grass. And it's only after the flood that you have this domestication of animals and the dominion over animals coming so far that they can also eat them. But even then, they have to be careful to pour out the blood first to the Lord. And there are certain animals. What makes an animal clean and what makes it unclean? What makes it kosher and what makes it unkosher? How come a pig is a no-no in Israelite culture? Pardon?
Something about the hook.
That's a rule of thumb, yeah, and chewing the cud. But I think that's not that's just a general rule of thumb. I think there was behind that general rule of thumb, there was something really quite important.
Question. Why do they use the number 7 so often?
It may go back to, it was kind of a general sort of thing, it may go back to the 7 wandering planets. And it was a very old sacred number throughout. And here you see they have to have 7 of the clean ones, because when he gets out, he's going to have at great expense, he's going to give a wonderful sacrifice. That's what people do when they're rescued, no matter who they are. And he's going to give this sacrifice a whole sacrifice, so he's not even part of a barbecue for them. But now to come back to this business of what makes it clean and unclean, usually whatever the Canaanites worshipped, especially the animal for Baal was a pig. Very common. And to eat pork was therefore to be eating a communion meal in which you were in connection with Baal. That was just the common thing, you see that? Let's take it something like this, that if you're going to... there are many other unclean things, some of these creepy, crawly things, were simply worshipped by the Canaanites. And so the priest simply kept them away. Why does a dead body make someone unclean? It's not an unclean animal, but just to take that as another example. Pig is unclean because that's the Canaanite sacrifice, and then you shouldn't take part of that.
Did the Canaanites eat pig?
Oh, yeah, and they had great festivals. And fertility cults and everything else. Oh yeah, the Canaanites had it, and so the Israelites can't do it. Yeah. So that's what is behind it. It's not trichinosis or something like that. But only Americans with refrigerators would get that idea. No, a dead body? Why does a dead body make you unclean? It's because of the germs? No, because the Canaanites go there to the grave and what? Consult the spirits of the dead, and the priests don't want you to do that. So therefore, a dead body is unclean. It's a no-no. And, well, this will come up tomorrow when we take the section on chapter 9 of shedding blood and all these things. If you don't say thanks, receive it with thanksgiving, it's unclean. It's not kosher. Somehow, this is a religious reason, you see that. Now, there may be some other reasons that you get what they call New Guinea pig belly, and if you don't cook the pork and so forth, some of this just experiential thing. I think that may be behind it too. But I think here, isn't this interesting that included in that part of creation which is to survive is also not just the clean animals, but the unclean. They go along too. That's interesting. Did you have a comment here?
It just, what you say fascinates me, because as I understand the rules of keeping kosher now, there's nothing, priestly or ritualistic about it. It's a matter of of scrubbing and sterilizing and all this sort of thing. And I remember talking to Jewish friends who sublet their house for a year, and when they were coming back, we're going to get their kitchen ready to keep kosher again. I said, well, does that mean the rabbi comes over and consecrates it at some point? They said, no, nothing like that. We just have certain rules of scrubbing and sort of cleaning out the oven with some sort of propane burner. So there's been somewhere in history a radical shift from the notion of staying away from certain things because of their purely religious connotations and yeah. kosher rules now.
Yes, and also in kosher rule now, if a rabbi in a slaughterhouse, even though it's not, you see, the only place where you can really bring, since Josiah's Reformation, and that's in the Deuteronomic Law Code, a real sacrifice to God is in where the Dome of the Rock is in Jerusalem. That's why some people would like to have that Dome of the Rock removed. And they're beginning to have some prayer hymns now, where Jews will go into that mosque and pray as Jews, though it belongs to the Muslims. It's where Muhammad ascended to heaven. Potential danger problem. Wasn't it a few years ago that some man from Australia wanted to bring the end of the world by beginning to burn the mosque next door? The Al-Aqsa
Mosque.
Yeah, Al-Aqsa Mosque, sure. Well, what I'm saying is that the only place where you could shed blood after Josiah's Reformation, 622 BC, was on that rock, which is still underneath that beautiful Dome of the Rock. And you can't shed blood. But if you don't somehow, even Chicago at the stockyards, I saw that once, if you don't have the blood drawn out, the life is in the blood, and that's be given to God first. That's the way they did it at all altars. Next to the altar, there would always be this place where you put the blood. In fact, they've got at the Jerusalem altar, you can see that in that, when you go inside the Dome of the Rock, you can see where they had the sewer. It went all the way down. Some of the names later, even though it was holy, they use it for manure and for making all kinds of gardens and so forth. The rabbis talk about that, which is interesting. It didn't remain once consecrated all holy, but it was alive, you see that, and then you could eat it, you see that. And then that part of it is still remembered in what is called kosher meat. Yeah. Well, let's go on here a little farther. We get into our story a little more. Would you mind, Harold, reading the next book? Yeah, we might just get to the catastrophe itself. Here, we don't have to have a lot of comments because this is really a story now.
Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters came upon the earth. And Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives went with him into the ark to escape the waters of the flood. Of clean animals and of the animals that are not clean, and of birds, and of everything that creeps on the ground, two and two, male and female, went into the ark with Noah as God had commanded Noah. And after 7 days the waters of the flood came upon the earth.
All right, would you keep on the next part?
In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights.
All right, and the next row, just keep right on the same row there.
On the very same day, Noah and his sons, Shem and Ham and Japheth, and Noah's wife, and the three wives of his sons with them entered the ark. They had every beast according to its kind, and all the cattle according to their kinds, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth according to its kind, every bird of every sort. They went into the ark with Noah, two and two of all flesh, in which there was the breath of life. And they that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in.
Now coming back, you notice that last verse, as God commanded him, it's what you mentioned, Paul, here, or emphasized, that what he does has to do with everybody else, you see that, as the Lord commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. It's almost as if he kind of closes that door after everybody comes in. Do you see how priestly this is, that there's a procession, and they all go, and the children's beautiful arks with all of the animals, they do that marvelously. At Concordia Teachers College, second last year, was there, nearby St. Paul's Lutheran School, had as their spring pageant a Noah's Ark. It was the most marvelous sort of thing. All these kids dressed up, male and female, with all sorts of things, and they used their imagination. Half of them were black, and half of them were white. And they went and they portrayed this thing, and it simply brought down, our students were overjoyed, I was too. And when the rainbow finally came up at the end, everyone realized what in the world this meant. He somehow put that across, and these kids throwing kisses to the audience, as only little Negro boys can do, was one of the things that I remember. I think they caught the whole business. Sometimes a folk song, sometimes an artist can catch that whole thing. And I think these little arcs, you know, that I think a lot of us have learned that, with all the animals, two by two, that has a bit of sense here. And we have to be a bit more childlike. One thing I would say here about the 600th, I mentioned this already, even if you don't know the calendar, it's a sacred calendar, you can know that this is all on schedule. And if they go in on schedule, they'll come out on schedule too. Because the climax is going to be the first full day when you're free after the Passover. The 7th month, the 17th day. That will be the high point. And see, the 15th day of the sacred month, 15th day of Nisan at twilight is when you sacrifice the Passover lamb. Before, between the time the red disk of the sun disappeared over the horizon, it got dark. Twilight, you know, it's two types of light, it's night and darkness. And then the 16th day is Sabbath, and you can't move anywhere and do anything. You're not free. But the 17th day is important. So he goes in here on the 600th year of his life, the second month, the 17th day, and then after 150 days, that'd be 5 months, 30 days each, then you'll come to that climax. That's the important thing. And then, of course, the New Year's, then the Tishrei. So they somehow they're patterning that. It's something like as if we have this pattern according to the church year over there. We kind of know what happens at Easter time, you see that? And this is their sacred calendar, and they know it very well. What about this? In the beginning of chapter 1 in Genesis, you had the earth was without form and void, and darkness is over the deep. The Spirit of God, or the wind of God, is moving it. Here, you're going to have the same thing. And let's just keep on reading. I don't want to preclude talks, but let's get right on there. Nancy, would you mind reading the next part? Read the whole business all the way through 23 or 24.
The flood continued 40 days upon the earth, and the waters increased and bore up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark floated on the face of the waters. And the waters prevailed so mightily upon the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed upon the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep. And all flesh died that moved upon the earth, birds, cattle, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm upon the earth, and every man, everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life, died. He blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the ground, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the air. They were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left, and those that were with him in the ark. And the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days.
Yeah, I think it's the Jewish scholar Umberto Cassuto who simply says something like this, that all of creation now is in that little ark. It's just over the face of the waters. Kind of a nice little sentence, I forget precisely. The waters prevailed, and the waters prevailed, and the waters prevailed, isn't it? It just, you don't have to make a lot of comments. But I think the shocker in it, I don't know whether you all agree with me, is where it says in verse 23, he blotted them all out. Most people don't want to say that of God, do they? They say, well, he lets the catastrophe come. But to actually be truly monotheistic and say, he blotted them out. People don't like to say that. But says it here very, very strongly. Any comments on this?
That he blotted it out. What different inputs do we have, or interpretations do we have from old translations on that? Is it always that he blotted them out?
Yeah, it's like to erase them off the face of the earth. It's a word like that. It's very similar to erase. Like blot out my sins in Psalm 51. Erase them all. Get rid of them. And that's what he does here. It's a total annihilation of everything. In other words, everything that was there, you know, before God had created, and formed everything, you see, and fashioned everything in the first seven masterpieces that he made, Genesis 1. And now it's all going back to the same sort of thing. It's a tremendous sort of thing here. It all died. And the priest likes to say, these things died, those things died, these things died. And then only Noah was left, and those that were with him.
I'm curious, was there enough water disposed? And I mean, the whole earth was covered, or is it just the known earth?
Well, I don't think that they, I can't really tell you what their full conceptions of the universe were. They certainly weren't ours, and that we would ask the scientific question, is there enough water? I think that's kind of a blind alley for understanding this story. I don't think that it meant that. People have said that, yes and no. I think that you can only follow a story here as far as it will lead you. I know that this 15 cubits, I remember reading this in Steckhardt's Biblischen Geschichten long ago, that he said there was 15 cubits. It wasn't that there was that much water, but that it went 15 cubits over all the top. And he mentions, not Ararat, but he mentions the Himalayas. And now, I could imagine that the flood stories, and there are flood stories all over the world. There was, I understand, and correct me here, Herb, that those in India do mention Himalayas. But the Babylonians mentioned the ones that are closest to them, the Zagros. Whereas the Israelites here would mention the closest ones that they had here, Ararat. And I think the Mandan Indians would simply have their stories about this. They were very universal stories of flood, that the Mandan Indians simply went and went to the Rockies, which is understandable. So I don't think we can nail it down in these things. And I think the meaning of what you might call a primordial story is not dependent upon our nailing it down in time and space. There, I think, like with most of these things, there's a kind of an impenetrable barrier for us to translate them in any details. And if the, you know, the reality of the story is not thereby impinged either. Any other comments? Well, let's keep on. I put a star there in my editing in the next part. Sir, I don't know your name, but would you read the next part first, please? That's 1-5.
God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. And God made the wind blow over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of the heavens were closed. The rain from the heavens was restrained, and the waters receded from the earth continually. At the end of 150 days, the waters had abated. And in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest upon the mountains of Ararat. And the waters continued to abate until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen.
Yes, just a comment. Do you know that the ark was what? It had a draft, if you want to say. It's kind of a floating barge, isn't it? It's 30 feet, and I suppose it's got a draft of at least 15. So when the waters were 15 feet above the highest mountain, then it could float. But as soon as it came to the highest mountain, it hit right on the top, and it was caught there. That seems to be the idea. So now, at this precise time in their calendar, equal to Easter Day for Christians in our calendar, right after the Passover. Rather interesting. I don't think you have to allegorize that, but nevertheless, it's a Jewish calendar, the sacred calendar. And we still have Easter according to the old moon calendar, you see that. Let me just speak a little about the calendar. Some of you look a little odd here. If you have a moon calendar, let's see, how can I say it? Moon month, I think, is 29 days, 12 hours, 44 minutes. That means that if you have only moon months, you come all the way through, it won't equal the sun 365. It'll only be 360, more or less. It's a little wobbly. Does anybody know what the Israelites did? The Egyptians, when the Pharaoh sat on the throne, he said they had a really exact calendar, very early in their history, 30 days in a month. And when he sat on the throne, he had to swear that he would never change the Egyptian calendar, and he never did. And therefore, they lost, they lost 5 days time the other calendar got out of whack. Well, we still have in our calendar leap year to try to keep it in whack, but they were celebrating Christmas at the 4th of July, and it didn't make any difference in one man's lifetime too much, you know, but after some time, they had a whole circle. We know that. And it's a very interesting thing in Egyptian history. But does anybody know how did the Israelites do that? If you got, you've got a Sabbath week every 7 days, isn't it? That would make 28 days in 4 weeks in a month, isn't it? What are you going to do if the moon is really only 20, is more than that, is 29, 12? We would have a new moon day. You got a day off. You got a celebration day. And that happens, some of you might know the story that when Saul was angry with David and Jonathan was standing up for him, David went down to have an ancestral feast in Bethlehem because it was the new moon. And the first day he wasn't there, and then the second day he said, "Where is the son of Jesse?" He said, "Well, he went down to Bethlehem." And then Saul blew up. They celebrated 2 days because he thought that there was some plot down in Bethlehem. So they would add that. You've heard of that, haven't you? In the Romans, when they have their calendar, they would have intercalary days, days between the month. And the Israelites had to do that too, and the priests would take care of that. So it isn't quite as if some of the Seventh-day Adventists say that the Sabbath has always been from creation all the way through. No, in ancient times they had to climb this up. And, well, I'm getting way off the flat here, but I think for them this was quite significant. And the 10th day, until the 10th month, now the mountains, I suppose it's like when you're at the top of the mountains here, and then you can see all the rest of them all the way around the side, peeking out. But now the next part begins to be really, really interesting. Would you read that, please, for us? The whole business about the birds, especially about the raven, which is a kind of an experiment which is uncertain. It doesn't bring anything. But then the beautiful one about the dove. And notice the cooperation between these creatures, the human creature, Noah, and the avian creature, the dove, and how finally this brings a climax. Would you read that for us, please?
"And at the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made, and sent forth a raven, and it went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Then he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. But the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put forth his hand and took her, and brought her into the ark with him."
Isn't that nice? Even Picasso caught that one. He puts forth his hand, and the dove comes back. All right, keep on. Would you read some more for us?
"He waited another 7 days, and again he sent forth the dove out of the ark. And the dove came back to him in the evening, and lo, in her mouth a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth."
And one more, verse 12.
"Then he waited another 7 days and sent forth the dove, and she did not return to him anymore."
All right, and with the next person, Oscar, would you read the next, the verse 13?
"In the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried from off the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark, and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry."
Okay. Notice that's the Rosh Hashanah, the Jews call it, isn't it? New Year's Day. First month, the first day. It's all dry. All right, any comments on that section? It's a beautiful little section there. Why did ancient mariners have doves on board? That's what he seems to have here. It's not just because all the doves were there are two, of course. If you have two of every kind, you can have doves too.
If they let the dove go and it returned, they knew they were not that close to land.
Yeah, I suppose the dove flies higher or something like that, and I don't know, it's somehow or other that he's trying to probe in, you know, to the uncertainty, and the dove would be able to help. What's this business of the olive? Why is the olive a sign of peace?
Well,
and Shalom. We wouldn't know because we're not Mediterranean people. But if we were Mediterranean people in ancient times, everyone would know. First came to me as a classics scholar when in warfare in Greece, the first thing the enemy did, I always thought it was funny, when the Spartans would come up against the Athenians or something like that, the Athenians would go outside of their nice fortress, their town, and they would fight with the superior Spartans and mix it up with them, trying to fight it out on a phalanx map. Why? Because otherwise the Spartans would destroy all their olive trees. That means all their fat, and that means really loss of fat for the next generation, because it takes a generation for the olives to grow again. And so therefore you'd risk the battle, even against superior forces, to try to save your olive trees. But then if you couldn't, then you'd finally go back in your fortress. And so everybody kind of knows that if the enemy gets after your olive trees. So the olive leaf here is a very great, strong symbol of peace, because you can only have a crop of that if there's peace. And I think Picasso has that. And all the story does here with that sort of symbol is that it's got a freshly picked olive leaf, so no one knew that the waters were subsided from the earth. I don't think that that people used to think that, and I like St. Augustine. St. Augustine, when they would say that there are all kinds of miracles that the olives could now bloom and all this, he said, "Miracula non sunt multiplicanda." Don't multiply miracles just to get outside of your interpretations and so forth. And I think that's a very wise thing. Some people have had the geological coal fields and everything else formed in flood geology and everything else through all this business. Someone mentioned it here when we were talking about the earlier parts that there used to be a lot of water in the firmament all the way up above there that was held there, and then all of a sudden in the flood this all came down. And before that, men lived so long because the cosmic rains hadn't gone through that big ocean of water. Now we don't live so long because we don't have that canopy. We're not in a kind of a greenhouse. All those things I don't think would be occurring to the Israelites, even though they occurred to our people in our culture. Here, the real emphasis I would see here is that the waters are dried and the face of the ground is dry. There's a survival. Anyone have any comments yet?
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned the other day when we were walking, you mentioned Picasso here. You go to the catacombs south of Rome, you get some of the earliest of the Christian art underneath the ground there. The tombstones, that the symbol is not the cross, but the symbol is the dove with the branch in her mouth.
Mm-hmm.
The early Christian art, they picked up this. Mm-hmm. It meant, must have had a deep meaning then, that the early Christian community.
Mm-hmm. Well, at Jesus' baptism you have the Holy Spirit in the form of a dove coming. It must have been, I don't know the fullness of that, but there's great symbolism there. I don't know just how that was used by the rabbi, but it would be very interesting to check that out.
And then here, but he was actually the dove with the branch.
Yeah, with the branch.
And that's the tombstone
symbol. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, can we have you read the next part, the exit from the ark? It's very interesting.
In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dry. Then God said to Noah, "Go forth from the ark, you and your wife, and your sons' wives with you. Bring forth with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may breed abundantly on the earth, and be fruitful and multiply upon the earth." So Noah went forth, and his sons and his wife, and his sons' wives with him. And every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves upon the earth, went forth by families out of the ark.
Yes, it's a nice procession, isn't it? You can almost see them going out two by two with God's blessing. They've been preserved, and now they go forth. Can anyone ask this question? How come he has to wait from the first month, the first day, to the second month, the 27th day? They talk about the patience of Job. I don't think Job was very patient, but they should talk about the patience of Noah. with all the household duties he must have had inside of that. That's if you want to time and space-ize it. But does anyone know, why in the world is it to the second month, in the second month, the 27th year of the month, the 601st year of Noah? What's it, what are you trying to tell?
It's a year clock. It's a little over a year from when the...
Yeah, from when what?
From when the rains began.
Yes.
That was the second month, the 17th day of the month.
Yeah, let's put it down here, just to get that straight. The second month, the 17th day of the month, was when the windows of heaven were opened and the fountains of deep and the Geshem came down. That's the torrent that comes down. And then you're right that seventh month, the 17th day, and this is the date in the calendar that called the shots. Now God remembered them and the ark hit there and now the water is going to go down. They go down, then you've got the 10th month, then you've got the first month. But now, when they come out, the second month, notice, the 27th day of the month. Rabbinical's books on the flood says, well, the flood lasted a year and 10 days. No. According to their sacred calendar, it's lasting 12 moon months and plus 10 days. Because a moon year is, did I say it was 5 days off? It's 10 days off. 355 days. So you've got to add the extra 10 so that they go out. Here they went in, you see that? Or here the Geshem, the water has been. It was 7 days before that. And by the way, if you want 7 days before that, go into the ark, and yet 7 days will come. That would mean that the announcement, when God announced the flood, must have been comparable to this day here, the first month of the. The first day of the first month in year 600, and here it's the first month and the first day in the 601st year of Noah's life. So these are kind of parallels. And if you take the 365 moon months plus the extra 10 days, then you get 365. And where have we had 365? Does anyone know where it's in Genesis?
Remember, Enoch lived 365 days. He walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. All the others, you know, they have long lives and so forth, and that one comes much shorter, 365. So I think that there's a lot of symbolism here, and naturally leave it up to these priests who had to do all that stuff to tell the story in those terms, which is their sacred calendar, you might say.
That's a nice Hebrew numerological explanation to all that, and it's very likely right, but I have another one.
Yeah.
The reason they had to wait that long before they went out of the ark was that Mrs. Noah didn't want them tracking all that mud in. She wanted to wait until it dried up a little bit out there.
Well, I have a friend who used to be on our staff at Concordia Teachers College in River Forest, who lives in Galena, Illinois. That's not far from where you guys live. His name is, Art Geisert. And he lives in a Noah's Ark. He's built on the top of Galena there in the last days of the 60s, his own little place up there. And he gave up on academia. And he went up there, and he lives, his son is Noah, by the way. His grandchild is named Noah. His wife teaches school, I guess, in Dubuque somewhere. But he is an artist. And a good share of his stuff is all with Noah. He's got Noah on the brain. And he really means it. He takes it quite seriously that we're an endangered species. And he has a whole bunch of plates, and they're really good. If you ever want to see some of that art, it's really interesting. The Crescent once had a whole issue on some of his stuff. And he had just that, that they had to wait in all the mud. And then he had derricks for getting the hippopotamus out. And he has all kinds of stuff. So, Myron, if you want to update all this stuff the way you're doing with the prodigal son, you could do this tremendously here. You want to write your novel, man.
Well, unfortunately, I'm behind because at the church to which the Lundholms and we belong, a man came with a model. of the ark for the LCW, Lutheran Church Women Monthly Meeting.
Yeah.
And described all to them, the ventilation system, the disposal system.
Well, if you...
He built his ark.
Yeah, well, you can get that if you have... Go to this movie. Some of you have seen Looking for Noah's Ark and Finding Noah's Ark, and there's a book on it, too. What bothers me is that those guys make a lot of money. It's just like this Hal Lindsey running the late great planet Earth and running around in Cadillacs. If that's what the end of the world is, then I think you might do something else with your money. And here, these guys, sure, they get a free trip to Europe every year. And what kind of archaeology can you do up there? Maybe we'll talk about that next time. All the time is running out here, isn't it? It's 16,000 feet. It's higher than Mount Rainier. I think that they have found, there's no doubt about that, this Frenchman, especially Navarre, has found some real timbers up there. And they're made of cedar, like gopher wood. Now, the problem is that you can neither do decent archaeology there, and these guys are not even equipped for archaeology. They're just something else, like the UFOers. No real reports have been there. And then when you bring the stuff down and you put it there, it depends upon all the glacial ice that goes through this. You don't have decent material, so how are you going to find out, you know, what sort of material they have found? G. Ernest Wright from Harvard, late G. Ernest Wright, simply said, I think he's right, that they had a lot of, in Armenian, early Christians, and other people, was a great legend even before the Christians took this over, that they had a big tourist trade up there, and they had monasteries, and they had a lot of it, so why shouldn't there be structures up there, and why shouldn't they find that sort of stuff? And the latest of the dating, and I have a whole file on that, I keep everything I can, from scientific reports at least, they've taken it down here to Livermore in California, other places, where is this wood from Noah's Ark, you know? And recently they got one of these congressmen, and if you have enough political pull, and some of those guys really have the political pull, you can look at the astronauts, and they found a speck up there. And now they found two specks. One is because it's such a long thing. Part of it is broken up here, and part of it is broken down there, see? And therefore, where did you say that they had to model the whole thing?
Okay.
Yeah, and even the ventilation. Well, my friend Art Geiser has it too, and he has his little Noah playing upstairs, and his wife washing the dishes, and all the animals having a great time. I wish I had brought that along. I never thought of bringing it along. I have one of those cuts, and it's really great. Well, I think we'll have to stop here, and that's all right, because this last section is really quite heavy theologically. It doesn't take so long, but when they come out of the ark, when they praise God, and how creation is reestablished. Did you notice the last part that the lady read, where it says, that they may breed abundantly in the earth, be fruitful and multiply on the earth. We're going back to creation again, aren't we? And that's why I said this is a necessary supplement to the creation thing. And we don't think we understand creation yet. And that's the way the Babylonians used it. It was during their New Year's festival that they read this story. It was part of the pericope, the sacred thing, to show that now the earth is renewed and is ready.